This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
All right, good morning, everybody. How's it going? Everybody handling the heat? Oh, gosh, I live out in Mali Adumim, which is on the way down to the Dead Sea, and it's a good 4 or 5 degrees hotter out there. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's the real thing. Okay, so it's, in my mind, day two, but you guys are on day three. And you have to forgive me, somehow my left ear is not working. Apparently you guys blew me away on Sunday, and I woke up in the morning only able to hear on one side. So if I look at you a little funny when you ask a question, just so you can repeat yourself. So what we want to talk about today is wolves. And oddly enough, I don't just mean that metaphorically, I actually mean it literally. And we're going to get a good look, I think, particularly at Sefer Nehemiah. But before we start, you guys have the sheets there. There's a story in the book of Ezra, which to me has always been quite significant. Those of us who got to learn together on Sunday spoke about the fact that it's my reading of the Tanakh and also my understanding of history that the exiles to Babylon went with text. Text. They brought some sort of text with them. And by the way, this is a big question for those of you who are interested in the way in which the text that we call both the Torah and the Bible in general came about. There's always a simple, I'll do it now as a thought experiment. If you were a good Israelite, remembering, of course, there is no such thing as Jew in the first temple times, but if you were a good Israelite living in the prophetic era and you wanted to know what God wanted of you, and you have two options, right? There are a bunch of scrolls somewhere that you could look into and try to determine what they mean, provided, of course, that you were literate. Or there was a guy or a woman down the street who spoke in the voice of God. Which one would you access? Right. I don't think I've ever had anyone other than some of my more difficult students tell me that I would go learn the scrolls. Right? It's a very important question that we should think about in our relationship to text. At what point does text move into the center as the primary medium of our relationship to God? And the prophet move out, right? And yeah. So we don't have any real proof for it. There is one I'm aware of, one textual argument which gets a lot of attention in the more traditional narrative in the book of Shoftim. If people know the book of Judges, there's a story of Gideon, right? Great couple of chapters, one of the good, like really meaty stories in Judges. And at the end, if you guys recall, Gideon starts off as a nobody, and then he rebels against Midian, and then nobody wants to follow him. When he demands help from a particular city, Sukkot and Penuel, they basically say, well, you come back and show us that you've had victory, and then we'll help you out. And he says, I'm going to come back, and I will beat the elders of this city with thorns. So indeed, of course, he wins, he comes back, and he grabs a kid, and he says, write down for me everyone who is in charge of this city. So everybody points to that and says, hey, he just grabbed some kid off the street who can write. Although, the truth of the matter is, this simple reading of the text might just be, I'll write, you dictate. We don't know.
Yeah. There's some archaeological evidence of soldiers sending back and forth messages regarding logistics.
From the first temple times? Really? I would love to know that. Great, that's very interesting. So here we might have even more. The assumption has always been that Am Yisrael has been far more literate than the average because we're a people has put such a heavy emphasis on text. And the question that I'm asking is, when did that begin, right? And how much of that is what this classic and important, I dismiss in no way the importance of foundation myths, as I hope people picked up from the first session that we had together. I think it is a completely legitimate act to take one's current existence and project it backwards in order to set it on solid foundations. And that's indeed what I want to talk about today. So we have this story, which is right at the bridge of when the Jews had left and come back. Right? And you guys are familiar with this time period, hopefully, by this point. And the story is, if you want to see it inside, it's in the fourth chapter of the book of Ezra. It's really the first six lines. And of course, annoyingly, that the first six chapters of the book of Ezra is not a character. Right? What is the scene? Who leads the return in the beginning of the book of Ezra? Anybody remember? Zerubbabel. There's a guy whose name just doesn't get enough attention, right? Who happens to be of the line of David. He's there with the high priest. Yeah.
Is that a good name for a Jewish kid?
I actually know someone named Zerubbabel. And I'm telling you, yeah, well, you know, in the Israeli sort of national religious world, people will pull the darndest names out of the world. You know, yeah, I often wonder if he gets made fun of in school. What? Zruli. I think they call him Zruli, yeah. Anyway, I'm not going to go there right now. So here we are at this critical juncture of the leaving and returning. And I want to keep two things clearly in mind. First of all, the assertion I made on Sunday that exile is rooted in the sense that we belong somewhere else. Right? That if you don't have a sense you belong somewhere else, you're not in exile. You're either on vacation or just going through life. Right? I mean, and this is one of the things that really differentiates the history of the Jews from the histories of many other peoples who, when they immigrate to other lands, don't necessarily see themselves as in exile. Right? I don't know if, say, the German-American community sees itself as in exile from Germany or simply as an immigrant community living their life and holding on to their culture. Whereas the hallmark of Jewish history, most of it at least, is the sense that we belong somewhere else. And that creates a very particular type of identity that I want to keep in mind, because this is really a class about identity. Right? That's one piece. And the other piece is that sense that we belong somewhere else is rooted in text. It's rooted in the prophets saying when the exiles go away, right, Jeremiah says to them before they leave, you'll be back in 70 years. So there's another very important prophet, Isaiah, happens to be my favorite. I won't ask people to vote on whether you think Isaiah or Jeremiah is better, but I think we all know the answer. And in Isaiah, at the end of the book, there's a very powerful image, which to me is an inspiration for the future. And the line is, Beiti beit tefila yikare lekol ha'amim, right? That my house will be called a house of prayer for all peoples. Right? It is perhaps the most moving universalist vision that Isaiah offers amongst many. So presumably the exiles, aside from the fact that if you ask the biblical critics, that was written actually after our time period, I want to leave it aside for now, and we'll go in the internal narrative. Presumably, the exiles knew this vision, that someday, somehow, their parochial little worldview was going to be the center of a human revolution. So they go away, and they come back, and then our story occurs. Right? That when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the exiles were rebuilding the temple. Why were they rebuilding the temple? Cyrus said they could, but, I mean, presumably, was it in Cyrus's personal interest?
No, it was still the center of ritual observance.
So there is a definite center of ritual observance. Ezra is a priest. Many of the people who returned were priests, although many not. What else?
It's the sense that they were truly returning and not just sojourning briefly to go somewhere else.
It's a rooting. That's a very big act. A building is permanent. It's a place of location.
Do they have a sense at that time still that to have the presence of God within their community, they needed to have a temple?
Yes, it's very important, by the way, not to lose sight of this in what I call historical anachronism. For us, we've lived as a people for 2,000 years without the temple, and we are sort of intellectually and philosophically very removed from this time period. We might find it bizarre if I said to you, yeah, God has a house, and when you visit, you bring goats. Right? I don't mean to make fun, but, you know, it can be very hard to relate to, and that's a very important point, is that, but for the people of the time, this is what you did. The whole world did it this way, and furthermore, this idea of returning the presence of God, I want to keep that in the center of our focus, because if I asked you what is the purpose of the Torah, what would you tell me? So then the purpose of the Torah is to teach you how to do that?
Yeah.
Teach you how to relate to God and...
And live the way he wants you to live.
Live the way...
To teach you a way of life and that God should be always part of it.
To teach you a way of life which God is always part of.
Mm-hmm. Teach you a
way to connect. Way to connect. So
method. So
these are all because I think most of us, when I ask that question, are thinking more along the behavioral... legal, halachic. In the narrative of the Torah, the Jews go out from Egypt. I mean, the whole first part, you know, the Bereishis, the Gush, out from Egypt. There's a significant momentum toward where? What?
The land,
although there's a major pit stop at Sinai. Now, what happens at Sinai? get the Torah, and then what happens? Well, there's a pretty important piece in the middle that gets an unprecedented amount of ink in the Torah. What's that?
Golden
calf's an awkward incident we're going to talk about later.
Yes,
but I'm talking about four parshiot, building of the Mishkan. I would argue, by the way, just from a narrative standpoint, the Torah is telling you the purpose of the Torah is to teach you how to connect heaven and earth, to bring God's presence to earth, our behavior, a way of life. These things are all essential tools for that. But from a narrative perspective, it's God, and as the rabbis will say later, who hitaveh l'dira b'tachtonim, we desired a dwelling place in the lower world. So here the Jews are coming back, and they assume, from a narrative standpoint, well, that's what we got to do. Yes, theologically it makes sense to them. Yes, culturally and politically it's important to them. But I think that in their kishkas, so to speak, they figure that is the purpose of our existence. So here they come back and they start to do it. And what happens? Do the peoples around them join in and say, yay? No, it calls them adversaries. Zerubbabel and Yeshua, they start to rebuild, and all the peoples around them come and say, hey, you're back. Oh, this is great. We've been worshiping your God for 70 years while you were gone. Now, we'll speak perhaps a little bit in the session at 11 about who these people were, these peoples of the land, who get a very important cameo in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, which you may have already encountered. Right? But these peoples of the land gather around them and say, we've been worshiping your God for 70 years. Let us help you build. And what do the returnees say? They didn't even say thanks, right? They certainly say no thanks. They say, you know, now remember, this is a very delicate moment. They've come back because they believe the prophecy of Jeremiah is being fulfilled. Why don't they think that this is a fulfillment of the prophecy of Isaiah? Beiti, beit tefilah yikare lekol amim. My house will be a house for all peoples. You want to build the temple? Hey, let us help you. What would have happened in 1948 if all of the Arabs of this region had said, you're back! Amazing! Well, let's get this mosque out of the way and start to build. Yeah, I know it sounds silly. You know, I know it sounds, well, but the reality is, and this is an important distinction if you guys are reflecting on the difference between this time period and the 1948, would the Jews have been interested? And I'm going to get into that right now, but it's worth it for you to think about. But for our time period, that is not what happened, right? The Jews were quite interested in rebuilding the temple, and the peoples around them were quite interested in building it as well. But somehow, not for you to build a house to our God, says Zerubbabel, but for us. And our question I want to focus on today is why. Why was that their reaction? And what were the consequences of it? And most importantly, how did it both reflect and shape the identity, which I will argue started there at this moment and has carried us to this very day? And is, in fact, in my opinion, what is crumbling around us and is causing much of the trouble and much of the opportunity that Am Yisrael faces today. Right? A little bit of clarity, and then one more text, and we'll go on. What do I mean? Here we are. I think I mentioned you, I teach Jewish history here at Pardes, also elsewhere. And when I understand history, I actually understand it through a classic lens. Right? Are people familiar with this acronym? What's the word? I probably should have written this up before if I was smart. Right? It's Pardes. It's not just the institution that you happen to be sitting in, which welcome if you didn't realize the name. Right? It is also what is classically known as the four-tiered structure of textual interpretation, right? Pshat means what? Plain meaning. I like surface meaning because all my postmodern students, when I say plain meaning, they throw things at me. Meaning surface not in a superficial sense, but surface in the sense that it's where we all make contact. Whatever you want to argue to me about how this text came to be, whether it has an intrinsic meaning or not, we can all agree that, you know, chapter 4, line 1 says this. And by the way, if you've ever sat in shul and listened to the public reading of the Torah, this is the only place that you can agree upon the text. When the words come out of the reader's mouth, it's one thing. And when does it begin to change? As soon as it hits the ears. And this is a real challenge. But nevertheless, it is there, elusive though it may be. Next level is remez. What's this mean? It literally means hints. And I call this meaning in context. right? Meaning in context, the context being the Tanakh. This is, by the way, if you've ever learned the tools of intertextuality, right? There's a conversation going on between the book of Deuteronomy and the book of Isaiah, right? There are parallels between, like we spoke about, those of us that learned together on Sunday, between the book of Daniel and the story of Joseph. And there are many also emotional subtext. My favorite example is when the people come to the prophet Shmuel, Samuel, and they ask for a king. All of the commentators are confused by why Shmuel is upset. It seems that the people are doing exactly what the Torah wants them. Except, in my opinion, they all miss a very obvious answer. The people come to him, they say, you're old and your kids are no good. We want a king. It doesn't matter what they ask for after that. He's going to be upset. You know, and that's the emotional subtext, but that's from the local meaning in context. Next one is drash, which literally means in Hebrew to seek. It's very important, though. Beit Midrash is not a house of learning. It's a house of seeking. And it's certainly not a house of study. That would be a Beit Limud. Right? A Beit Midrash is a place that you seek, which is always important to remember because the stuff on the walls, the books there, is not actually the knowledge that you're after. It's the tools to get the knowledge you're after. Because you know where the knowledge you're after is? Well, this is meaning in total context. Now, things are starting to get more interesting. Because if I tell you that meaning in local context means here in this book, where's the total context lie? Let me help you out. Anybody ever read a midrash, rabbinic, you know? And you've ever had the experience, say, they took that verse completely out of context. Right, of course you have, because that's what they do. But no, they took it out of local context. And they put it back into total context. But where does that total context lie? If you were one of the rabbis of the Gemara, and you were reading Shir Shirim, and you saw, right, Tach Bikeni B'Yimino, that he hugged me with his right hand. And you said, oh, this is about God's love for Israel. Where does that idea come from? Okay, but is it in the text?
No.
Is it in the Tanakh? Where is it? I think it's so obvious you guys are getting it. It's in you. It's in you. The reader is the total context. Now, the sages, one of the reasons that they had the mastery of Midrash is because, first of all, of course, they knew this entire text literally by heart. And so, therefore, the local context was completely at their fingertips. And furthermore, they had a tradition of interpretation, of understanding, perhaps even knowledge that had been handed down. So they were holding the whole context. But this is critical because the total context is within the reader at that level, which begs the question of whether we ourselves can indulge in Midrash. Which people do all the time. It is only a question of hierarchy of authority between the books there and here, which is legitimate. I don't know the whole Tanakh by heart. Like, you know, you had a question. Question over there.
Where are you positioning in between text, you know, or are you remaining on here at different times that ringing a bell, right? Or like Google say, I only got to this place because God wanted me here. These are parallel texts. Is that in Remez or in Drush?
Parallel text is in Remez. If the meaning emerges from the placement in the Tanakh and the actual wording, we call that Remez. Although these are not hard and fast categories, as you're already sensing. The last level, and then you'll get to why are we talking about this in a story about walls, right? Last level is Sod. What does Sod mean?
Secret.
Secret, right? And its meaning, I would call it meaning understood, but not communicated. The other way to say this is it's the experience of meaning. What do I mean? That on some level, and often people associate what with Sod? Kabbalah, the mystical teachings. It's a big, important thing to remember, that the purpose of all mystical teachings is not a Jewish phenomenon, it's a human phenomenon, is to point the way. Mystical teachings can be a barrier to God, or they can be a signpost. They can never actually be the thing itself. If you're reading mystical texts with the purpose of mastering the text, then you are stuck here. And at best, you might get some knowledge. If you're reading mystical texts looking for God, at some point, the book has to fall from your hands. Right? Otherwise, it becomes a substitute. This is meaning which is purely within the reader. It is no longer even in the reader's interaction with the text. If people have ever read Chassidut, often particularly the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad. And if you've ever read the Likutei Torah for any reasons, you've had the experience that he starts out with a verse and then just seems to jump off a cliff. And at the end, he comes back to that verse, and you say to yourself, I'm sorry, what just happened? And that's because most people are expecting his comments to be a drush, and somehow a reaction to. But what you're actually seeing, as I've been taught by my teachers, is that he began as a meditation on the verse and went somewhere else. And then he came back to his meditation, but there is an unbridgeable gap between them. This is meaning that even to communicate it to another person is not actually possible. So, of course, a secret is something you don't tell others. This, by the way, is useful if you've never thought about how to engage text. And the argument in textual learning is that each level always exists. And it can be fun to play with it. What level does my understanding lie in, and how do I move between them? But for our purposes, when I teach history, I have an argument, a thesis. In fact, if people are curious, I can send you all kinds of written and audio material on it, that these are also phases of Jewish history. History of consciousness. Going from creation through crossing the Jordan. Right? This is the dream time. There was no story to Abraham, Yitzchak. Moshe already knew there was a story because he says, you know, wipe me from your book. But, you know, could you imagine what it was like when Moses came down from the mountain and the children of Israel says, what did you get? And he showed them a book that talked about what they did yesterday. Just theology aside, just from an internal narrative perspective. And they say, what? You don't understand. Give us laws. Tell us what God wants. He's saying, you missed it. You are living life. This is the dream time when there's really no distinction. Crossing the Jordan is the process of embodiment. Right? The whole first temple period that we've been speaking about, I use the phrase on Sunday, it was the time when the kingdom of flesh and blood was meant to embody the kingdom of God. It failed, mind you, but that was the vision. A temple, prophets, kings were supposed to live a way which is the light to the world such that anybody who crosses that river and sees what's happening here says, there is a God. And you know, do you think Solomon was bothered by what the Chinese would think of the Jews being the chosen people? Solomon didn't know the Chinese existed, right? This is the period of adolescence. I spoke about my daughter before, and gosh, she gets a hard time in these classes. I hope she doesn't listen. Anybody who has ever raised an adolescent or been one themselves knows that the power of adolescence is that you exist purely in your own context. As was rightfully so, because of course, anybody here an artist? Creator, and don't have to be professional or anything. Poetry, music, dance, anything? No, nobody? Okay, if you've ever had a creative experience, you know there's a point at which you need to reach within yourself and you cannot create in context of what others think. In order to find your voice, it has to be a purely, not egotistical, but egocentric act. Now, if you want to communicate with others, there's a point at which you need to emerge. But that's what adolescence is. It's a finding of the voice. This, of course, is the period in which the Tanakh is written. Even from the biblical critical perspective, forget the internal narrative. This is the period of finding voice for Am Yisrael, and it ends exactly where our story begins, at the return to Zion. Because now, we're going to be a people not purely in context of ourselves as a bunch of adolescents, but a people in context of other. We have a sense of self, but we've gone away to Bavel and come back. And one of the first things that happens when we come back is a bunch of people approach us and say, hey, we want to be just like you. And we say no. By the way, down the line, what's coming, you know what the next major historical event is here? Greece. The Greek encounter, which was love at first sight until it went bad. Right? And much of the story of the Maccabees is a story about what happens when you don't actually understand why Ezra and Nehemiah and Zerubbabel said, whoa, thanks but no thanks. It's not for you to build a temple to our God. Just to finish the picture, by the way, there's a big question here. I'm going to make an argument, which we can discuss some other time because it's not the focus of our class, that this period ends at the exile from Spain, or the expulsion. and that we live in a fundamentally different world. But it hasn't caught up with us. Just to give you an example, how many of you assume that your Jewish identity is dependent upon the rejection of other? How many of you assume that your Jewish identity is dependent upon the rejection of other?
Entirely.
It is, however, a major momentum within what it means to be Jewish. From the idea of not eating other people's foods, to the idea of not sharing other people's ideas about God, to not living in neighborhoods, to not marrying their children, to all kinds of different things. And yet, I'd imagine in this room, all of us have overlapping identities. I'm an American, I'm a Jew, I'm an Israeli, I'm a human being, I'm a woman, I'm a man, I'm something in between, whatever it is. There's all kinds of complexity, and we are used to complexity and identity. Now, to return to our story before we get going into the learning, what role does this act of rejection serve? I'll ask it differently. Why do they say no? The exiles go away with the book of Jeremiah, book of Jeremiah, and they're totally convinced in 70 years. We saw the beginning of Ezra. Says the word of the Lord at the mouth of the mouth of Jeremiah. That's why Cyrus is sending us back. Prophecy is being fulfilled. Why then is prophecy not being fulfilled in their minds when the peoples of their country, of their land, come to them and say, let us build the temple together? What do you guys think? Why would they say thank you, but no thank you?
Well, they already had a tremendous problem with assimilation of people who came to America.
Right. It's interesting. Assimilation, intermarriage, and blurring of lines. Are those the same thing?
They can be.
By the way, let's start here because I think it's actually easier. Intermarriage, always a bad thing?
Well, the question was, are they going to adopt as a state the wife or the husband's worship of God?
So I want to keep this question on the board because one of the major stories we're going to look at in the book of Ezra here is the book of Ezra is the first place where the concept of intermarriage appears in the Tanakh. There is no such thing in the Torah.
Just from a historical point of view, do we have any idea of whether intermarriage was an issue for the exiles in Babylon while they were in Babylon? Did the community of those people in 7 years
to intermarriage? I'm sure people have written papers on it. From my knowledge of the Tanakh, you would have to make a supposition that it wasn't. Because it's only once the phenomenon was pointed out to Ezra that he actually began to do something about it. Presumably, as a community leader, if he knew it was a problem, he would have prepared for it.
So you're saying it was the leader. I'm saying here's a group of people who came back. Some of them were probably tired from the trip and didn't really care. They just were happy to be there.
Right.
So you're talking about when you say the they.
Who's the they? Could have been. And by the way, we're going to talk a little bit about that later in the morning in the next class, but it's always important to remember who's telling the story. It's always important to remember who's telling the story.
Well, also, he doesn't say you have a lot of problems that stems from intermarriage. He just says you're intermarried.
Right, well, we're going to get that. I want to leave that just on the board. We're going to get to that story. Specifically, the specific question here is why would they say no? Right.
So the exiles who returned said, what you did was not legitimate in our eyes.
It's critical. Meaning when they say, we've been sacrificing to your God for 70 years, we say, no, you haven't. You may have been sacrificing to your idea of what our God wants, but who tells the story? Who's holding this sense of authenticity about what God actually wants? Great. And so, therefore, there's an automatic rejection. Other thoughts on why they would have said no? What? Let's ask it this way. What might have happened? Great.
It's like really binary. It's like black or white. It's really simple to say no.
Yeah. So there's a simplicity. Yes. And that, I think, is a really important. Because you know what one of the major tools of drash It's in many ways is an analytical standpoint. It's compare and contrast. My first degree is in geology. And when I first started to teach I started off teaching in post-high school yeshivot in the Orthodox world. And when my students would discover that I had a degree in geology, almost inevitably within the first month or two, somebody would come to me, sometimes with tears in their eyes, and say, can you explain to me this whole creation evolution thing? Right? And usually, after giving them some sort of sense of comfort, what I would say is, look, you have to understand, in order to compare two things, you have to understand them separately. Right? Because if you don't understand them separately, all you're doing is comparing your idea about them. You might learn a lot about yourself, but you won't learn anything about their relationship. So I would then point out, since you don't really understand evolution, and you don't really understand creation, let's actually get to the real question that's bothering you, which is like, how do I relate to the Torah in the world that I actually live in? But in the same way, here, there's a simplicity of saying no, because there's a wall there. Yeah? So authenticity in idea and a legitimacy in experience, right? Legitimacy. I mean, at the risk of getting out on the edge. I don't know if you guys have followed the Caitlyn Jenner story from the perspective of feminist theory. May sound feminist theory. There are a lot of feminist theoreticians who are extremely challenged by the transgender movement. A lot of it because of this, saying your inner sense of who you are does not change the fact that once upon a time you, let's see, outwardly were living the life of a man. In other words, you don't become a woman when you wake up in the morning. In the same way, you don't become a Jew when you wake up in the morning. Sometimes you don't become an African-American when you wake up, even though you may really believe. 100% legitimate, no judgment. You really are. But there's more to it than authenticity. Right? There's two sides to that coin.
Okay, so they were told by Cyrus to come and do a jab. And so...
Well, they were permitted by him, yeah. Yeah, that's an important, why do you ask? They were subjects of Cyrus still.
Well, because I think Cyrus needed a presence there, and I think his presence there was, he wanted it solid. I don't think he wanted it
mingled.
Yes.
So I want you to keep that in mind when you go off and do the learning next, is that they were definitely the forefront of a larger picture.
They were on a mission.
And the question is, for whom?
Yes.
Socio-political, cultural, yep.
Right.
Well, mentions in Tanakh that when you come back to the land, this is in the first case when they're coming in from
the desert,
Egypt,
yeah.
There will be people there, do not intermarry among them. You are told not to mingle among them. And so that is an earlier statement where intermarriage was prohibited.
True, although my point in saying there was no such concept was not that there was no prohibition. It's that what were they commanded to do to those people? Right, meaning there was the brownfield concept, right? It's a very important understanding of the change that in the book of Deuteronomy, the role of the non-Jews is to get out of the way or die.
Yeah.
In the book already of Isaiah, and you can see it a little bit earlier, but Isaiah is a good place to identify it. Like, there's a much more complex concept. If Am Yisrael is meant to be a light unto the nations, well, then the nations have a critical role. In fact, who's the primary? The light or the people benefiting from it? It's not so obvious. And if you're interested, by the way, you can go look at the first chapter of the Gemara in Avodah Zarah if you're curious about that question, about what exactly the relationship between the Jew and the non-Jew is meant to be in the book of Isaiah. I encourage you to go look at the first six pages of Avodah Zarah. It's a very complex discussion there. And you're right, it has changed. But because it has changed, it's much simpler to just say no. And get rid of them all, says the book of Deuteronomy. But either for practical reasons, it's not actually possible. If Joshua couldn't do it, nobody can. People should remember that, I hope. However, it might just be that the mission has shifted. So, last question I'm going to send you off to learn, because and I'll tell you what you're doing. What role or what purpose does a wall serve? Separation.
That's
right. Right.
Keeps people out and doesn't let people in.
keeps people out, doesn't let people in. There's one more thing. I mean, because keeping people out and doesn't let them in is the same thing. Robert Frost, good walls make good neighbors. Well, wall, fence. There's a difference. What's the difference between a wall and a fence? Interesting. Oh, yeah? Okay. That's an important metaphor. Right? So a wall keeps people out, but what else does it do? Keeps people in. Right? You know, if I put this stuff in there, what would anybody say this is? Oh, excellent. It's a cell. Right? And you know, there's this fascinating question of what is life? And you're thinking, where are we going with this? Can I spell this? Autopoiesis. Anybody know what autopoiesis is? It's a self-building system, which is arguably the best definition I've ever found of what life is. And what you will find that the number one definition of life is it always has a boundary. Right? That's why there's an argument amongst biologists whether a virus is really alive. Because what a virus is something that doesn't have its own boundary. It co-opts that of others. Right? And the construction of a boundary is part and parcel of life is. However, if we go with the metaphor here, if this is a cell wall, is it impermeable? It's impermeable? What happens if a cell wall becomes impermeable? You got nothing there. Because though life is about constructing a boundary, if life succeeds too much, it dies. Right? There must be a relationship to the larger. Okay. This is the setup. Questions or comments before we start to get into the learning? Really? Okay. So this is what you're looking at here. Yes. Mm-hmm. It is. And that is, in fact, source 3.
Was the book of Ruth written to show not all converts are bad?
So as far as I know, I mean, from an internal narrative, the book of Ruth was written in the time of the judges, which is well before this, but also a time of real challenge of mingling. The biblical critics, I believe, don't quote me on this, put the book of Ruth even later than this. Do they put it later than Daniel? I don't know. It's not really my field, but it is in a time period, be it in its internal narrative or in its historical writing context, where this question would be quite present. It's a good point. And that's our first source, actually the second source here. Okay, ready to do some learning? Okay, so what you're looking at here is the first, you know what? The first is the translation is below it. I would say, for the sake of time, you should ignore source 2. This the Sifra de Agadata Esther. It's interesting, but I think it's going to take us too much on a sort of a rabbit trail to the side. So source 3 is from the Book of Ezra, chapter 9, lines 1-9. You see how it just lists it because you have the whole book there. Meaning, if you look in your source sheet, source 3 says Ezra, chapter 9. Lines 1-9, but in the back of your book, you have the whole book of Ezra. So, up front, okay, thank you. So that is the story that a couple of people have mentioned when Ezra learns about the issue of intermarriage. So first I'll read that, and then what I've brought you in sources 4, 5, and 6, so 4, 5, and 6, what I brought you was a couple of commentators who focus on the word gader. The word gader in Hebrew means fence, wall, boundary, because Ezra makes this very evocative statement saying that God has given us a boundary. First of all, in your own reading, figure out, what does he mean? And specifically, it's I believe it's the 9th line of chapter 9. I'm not looking at it right now. Sorry, let me get to the text here, make sure to point in the right direction. Chapter 8 is really long. Yes. It's the 9th line of chapter 9. So again, read lines 1-9. Think about this whole list of why, what are the challenges that they were facing, and how is he responding? And then you look at these commentators and see how they understand specifically, why does he characterize what God has given them on their return as a gader, as a boundary? And by the way, good, bad, how does it reflect? Always at this point in the seminar, you should be thinking about how does it reflect on our current situation? So that's really the first task in the book of Ezra. The next thing, if you turn your page, you'll see that sources 7 through 11 are all just quotations or references to the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is a fascinating book. We haven't talked about him yet, at least I haven't talked about him yet, where the idea of building a wall takes a huge role. Now, there's a lot here, so you can do with it as you will, but in particular, please take a look at 10, source 10, which is a very interesting and often missed event, which is the dedication of the walls of Jerusalem. I'm talking about source 10. Source 10. You're looking at the source sheet there?
Source 10.
Source 10, which gives you a quotation.
Oh, source 10 is chapter 12?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I'm not going anywhere, so if people need help. Well, I'll help you one second. People want questions before people can get started learning, and then I'll circulate around to help with any confusion. Oh, how much time? Oh, at least 40 minutes. So what time is it right now? It's 9:43. So let's aim for 10:30, and we'll take the last half hour just to wrap things up. Yeah? Sure. First of all, in Ezra, why in Ezra, in the ninth line there, why does he choose the word gader? Why does he say what God has given us of all things is a wall? And then in your own mind, you can think about it and then compare what these three different commentators have to say. And then in Nehemiah, really, if you get however many of those citations you see, what does a wall represent in the book of Nehemiah? Because it is the driving force of the entire book. Oddly, it's quite odd if you look at it. The building of the wall, the rededication of the wall, how he uses the wall, and that's what I've given you there. Does that help? Okay. Let's get to work. Okay. There's no end to the work here, and I know I gave you guys a lot of stuff, but just so we can have the last half hour to try to put the pieces together, I'm just going to interrupt you in the middle, sorry. So what did you guys see here in the ninth chapter of Ezra? How would you characterize what it is or why it is that he chose the word wall, gader? Right? Let's see if we can get some space here. Just in your own reading, before we get to the commentators, why would he characterize, or you can put it this way, what else might he have said? What did God give them there? Right, so a couple of people pointed out to me that the translation, which is not mine, my guess is it's probably from Sfaria, since it's the easiest place to lift online text. Not lift, that's what it's for. If you guys, by the way, haven't heard of Sfaria, I'll just do a completely unnecessary plug for them. Amazing website of free open source attempt to put all Jewish knowledge at your fingertips. So check it out. You can ask me about it later. Free open source, amazing.
Gader is a physical image.
So gader is a very physical image. And well, let's get our definition. When we have the translator there used hold, we have the element of the physicality is very important here. What other elements came up for you guys?
The phrase gader l'torah. There's a phrase about putting a fence around the Torah.
Right, well, the word is really there is siag, but nevertheless, it functions the same way. So there's a parallelism to Torah, and there's a major text that I left out of here because you can only do so much about the role that Ezra played in that process, something we'll perhaps speak about more in the next session. So what else? Just things, associations, observations that you had in the text before we get to what you believe the commentators were saying.
Separation.
There's a separation there. You can call out if I'm not looking at you.
Force your rules if there's a porous, everybody's all milling about. That separation is a requirement in order to enforce rules separate from the general body.
Yeah, rules and boundaries go together. You know, I mean, something as a father, I can tell you that you're always better off if you live in a community that reflects your values. Well, I mean, I don't know if that's always true, because you know what the counter argument to that is. I mentioned it to at least one group, Chabad. Now I know not everybody loves Chabad, so you can have your own opinions about that. That's fine. I'm always impressed about the fact that Chabad families can drop themselves in the middle of any environment, and their children, not always, but in my experience, amazingly often, will continue to reflect the values from within, and without the sort of vehement opposition to other. So there is, it is true. I mean, when I chose to live where I live, I chose a community that would reflect these my own values in order that if I failed in my own personal boundaries, at least the immediate environment that my kids seeped out into would still be reflective. So there's definitely a relationship here.
By the way, there's a reason at 12 years old they send them.
Yes, of course. Of course. Yeah.
The sacred purpose of the wall, the priests, the Levites purified themselves, they purified the people.
Well, you're in Nehemiah already. You're in Nehemiah. I just want to focus first on Ezra, and we're gonna hit Nehemiah. We God willing, we will have time. So, say again.
Number nine or the whole?
Just the whole picture here, because well, okay, let's go through the narrative. What's the impetus? How does it happen? How does it happen? Tell me the story of these nine lines. Right. First of all, the fact that someone had to tell him, as a couple of people pointed out to me, is fascinating. I mean, here you have something which ends up being described as a widespread social phenomenon. Imagine, I mean, maybe some of you guys are community leaders at home. Right? Imagine you were the head of, I grew up in Cleveland, you were the head of the Cleveland Federation, right? Or the head of a major shul in Cleveland, I don't really care, whatever major communal position. And someone came to you and said, listen, rabbi, doctor, whatever, we have an intermarriage problem in Cleveland. You said, what? I can't believe it. That's terrible. What do you think the kind of reaction you would get would be? Where have you been for the last decade? Yeah, you know.
But then you also hear about people who sometimes you don't want to see and you don't see.
Ah, right?
So then somebody comes and says, did you know that your husband is doing this?
I never knew.
Right?
So great. So either what we're seeing here is reflective, because either way he's surprised. I mean, it could just be drama. What?
He's been in Bavel,
but at this point, it seems he's been back for a little while. Yeah, Ezra, remember, is a priest, and elsewhere, if you read the whole book, he's described as a sofer mahir b'torat Moshe, that he is an expert scribe. And our assumption here is not just a scribe in the sense of actually recording the text, but in terms of its comprehension. Ezra is the one, according certainly to the biblical critics, and even in my opinion, according to Gemara, who gave us the Torah in the form that we're familiar with. The Gemara says that Ezra translated the Torah originally from Hebrew into Aramaic, which is a different language, and from the ancient Hebrew script into the modern Hebrew script. The people rejected the change of language and they accepted the change of script. There's a deep Gemara there, but just on the surface of it, wait, did the sages just tell me that Ezra wrote the Torah? Yes, they told you that. Now, what they mean is, okay, that's a discussion, but meaning he's completely absorbed in the innermost workings. He's a priest. His focus is in the temple, right? What's that?
He doesn't look up much.
He may not look up much, and when he looks up, what does he choose to see? Meaning the two, I think you're absolutely right, is we can be blind for all kinds of reasons. By the way, he might also have been like one of those very righteous people that only wanted to see the good. We don't have to necessarily characterize this as bad. Right? There is a very important posture I can have in life. Again, I keep referring to it, but as a parent, I'm sure you guys are all familiar. You're much better off choosing to see the good most of the time, right? Because what we choose to see is actually what is emphasized in life. At the same time, if a crisis occurs and someone comes to me and says, hey, did you know that your friend is doing this? And I say, oh, I failed in my responsibility. And I think we see in Ezra's reaction here, which is quite extreme, right? Then what does he do? There was dirt in his head. He tears his clothes. He falls down and weeps before the ark, right? And then who does he summon?
The same people who are doing it.
No. First, who does he summon? All those who tremble before the word of the Lord. By the way, its first appearance is actually in Isaiah. The second appearance here, the phrase Haredim. That is where the modern Haredi community gets its name. It's from first from Isaiah. It's repeated here in Ezra. And you can just ask yourselves, what does it mean to define yourself by that which you fear? Right? Fear is a very important wall. You know? Again, positive, negative, or otherwise, I'm sure we could all make analyses. Like, on one hand, you don't want to live a life filled with fear. At the other hand, if I say to you, hey, there's a dragon in that room, and you say, oh, cool, let's go look, that's probably not the best lack of fear you could have, right? Meaning there are good reasons to be afraid of things, right, depending on what they are. At the same time, fear holds you back, right? This, again, this is power of this wall. So he summons all those people who are going to be afraid of the same things he's afraid of. And there's a very powerful question that came up from a number of people, which is, first, not only how did Ezra not know, and the sense, by the way, you can trace it all the way back to the beginning, that when Ezra does his census of who comes back with him, you get a sense, you know how many generations he counts of his own life? I think it's about 16. I don't remember it might be even more if you go back and just count. That's very impressive that he's able to count from his life back to our own 16 generations. I don't know about you guys, but I don't even know who my great-great-grandfather was.
I could go back to knock, but I forgot who's in
between. Well, by the way, there's a problem with him counting 16 generations back to Aaron. What is it? It is not enough time, people. It's not enough time. I mean, it's very impressive, 16 generations, but you need a lot more than that to go from, you know, the 6th century before the Common Era back to Aaron. The beginning of this, middle of the 7th chapter. Actually, no, I think it's actually the beginning. It's in the 7th chapter. That's just an interesting thought you can have about Ezra and who was he. But for now, it's clear that there's a group of people who came back who were what we call, they had yichus, right? They had lineage, they knew who they were, where they came from, how they got there. And then there was an even larger group of people who came back, why? Because they weren't making it in Babel. You have an ideological core, and you have the people whom life has pulled along with them. And then the other question that a number of people brought up is, who were these people that were already in the land when they came back? Is it really true the way we tell the story, that all of the Jews were taken away by Babel, and that therefore only the Jews came back and everybody else was there were foreign peoples? Or is it possible to consider that maybe some of the Jews stayed there?
Were they left there?
There were some that were even left. Yeah, it seems to be. Seems to be the story with Gedaliah and group. Yeah, there's a lot of unclarity here. And I believe that if you read the text closely, what you're seeing in all these stories is not just a ideologically and racially pure group of people who came back who are trying to hold off the other. You're also seeing a process of differentiation. Of who's with the story. Ezra comes back carrying the story. These two tools that I mentioned, that I've said to a couple people, of entirety and exclusivity. Entirety means we are the whole people. There is no other Israel. I want you to keep these in mind when you go talk to the Karaites this afternoon. Right? And once you establish entirety, well, then you can establish exclusivity, which is, and we tell the story. Right? Now you see how those two work together, is that the story is actually the primary tool for making the boundary. I mentioned to a couple other people today, right now in America, all over the world, but particularly in America, there's a whole discussion about intermarriage happening in the Jewish people. Well, on one hand, some people are telling the story that, well, we are the Jews and the intermarried people are not. There you go, there's that boundary. Right? You could tell the story the other way, which is, no, like, everybody who is married to a Jew is a Jew. We could tell the story even further, right? You're a Jew by choice. We're all Jews by choice today, God knows, at this point in history on some level, right? So therefore, anybody who identifies with the Jewish people are part of the story. Here in Israel, you know how this finds its most difficult expression? What about a soldier who dies in combat, who happens to have been born to a non-Jewish mother?
Or someone who says she's not Jewish.
Or someone who says she's not Jewish, or what have you. Meaning, here you have a soldier who just died in combat in service of the state of Israel, and certainly in terms of the people of Israel, in the land of Israel. And by the way, halachically, it's not Jewish. And one of the challenges that this country has not yet been able to face is that are we able to say, okay, that's true, but this is true as well. Meaning, where is the boundary of the story? Right? And you're here, you're seeing in Ezra, is he has just decided one of the boundaries of the story is where? Intermarriage. And when I said earlier that there's no such thing as intermarriage in the Torah, a couple people said, wait a minute. I mean, Ezra's quoting, basically quoting the Torah, you cannot marry these, you cannot marry those. I'm like, wait, what, like, isn't that? Yeah. What's the difference between marriage and intermarriage? We had this discussion with a couple of people. So I would say it's the difference between a majority culture and a minority culture. Historically, probably the best example is Islam. Right? According to this simple reading of Islamic law, that any time a woman marries a Muslim man, through the process of marriage, she becomes a Muslim. Right? So since Islam, historically, women didn't have independent status anyway, that meant there was no problem with intermarriage. There's just no such thing. Because intermarriage presumes that the other culture maintains its integrity. Right? So in the Torah, there was no problem of intermarriage. Not because Jews or Israelites didn't marry non-Israelites, but because there was no legitimacy given to the other culture. In fact, the only places you can look for the actual phenomenon of intermarriage is the places where legitimacy was given to the other cultures. You're not allowed to marry Egyptians, you're not allowed to marry Amorites, because those are people who actually have a legitimate place where they live, as opposed to the seven nations that were living in the land of Canaan, who had no legitimacy whatsoever in the mind of Deuteronomy. You follow the difference? So now Ezra's coming back, and they are a minority culture, and suddenly intermarriage becomes a really big deal, because you marry this other nation, they don't just go away. No, I'm going to leave it as a hang, because I don't want to divert it. It's a very painful question in Israel today.
Right, but they're not recognized, and they're not buried in the Jewish cemetery.
Well, careful. They are recognized and honored. They're not buried in a Jewish cemetery. The military has a way in which it's done. My experience is that's not true. I can tell you in Mali Adamim, where I go to the Yom HaZikaron ceremony, they make no differentiation about who is recognized.
I have been exposed to a program about 5 years ago, I don't know, ongoing, which the military has, specifically for the Russian people who came in, and they could not clarify really their mother's
status.
Halachic
status,
and that, and that it was a dual military conversion program.
Yes, it's called Nativ. But yeah, it still exists. I mean, these are huge questions in this country, which I don't mean to treat lightly at all. Please don't misunderstand. I just don't want to divert too much into it. But you see how this kind of point of pain goes to the core of, like, who gets to claim exclusivity over the story and therefore the boundary of the people? Here, it's Ezra. There's no contest. Why? I don't know if you guys know how this story plays out in the end, but basically, he beats the people into line. And he forces them to divorce their non-Jewish wives and disown their children. And there's a huge question in the book of Ezra, like, why did they listen to him? Right? At the end of the day, here 2,500 years later, we're reading the book of Ezra. And one of the deep questions that we need to engage with whatever pain and difficulty we have around this type of behavior is, would we still be doing so if he had not done this? Right? Because the power of simplicity is in the clarity that it offers. At the same time, as I was speaking about with some people, the one source I had you skip, which I actually regret, but whatever, there's only so much we can do, right? At the end of that first story we started with, Jews come back, and the nations greet them and say, hey, you're rebuilding, let us help you. We say, nothing doing. At the end of that story, everybody starts to send letters back to the Persian king. Right? The peoples around them send letters back saying, these Jews are going to rebel against you, don't let them rebuild. The Jews send letters back saying, no, we're just doing what you told us to do. And you know who the Midrash says carried those letters back? on behalf of the Jews, it was Mordechai. And on behalf of the non-Jews, it was Haman. But we're used to reading the Megillah and saying, gosh, this Haman guy, he's just pure evil. He just hates us. We haven't done anything. Here are the rabbis, much, much later, looking and saying, well, we did do one thing, which was what? We're not you. Now, the sages followed through on that momentum. They were not hesitant about drawing lines between Jews and non-Jews. But they were also not ignorant of the price you pay for establishing identity through exclusivity. Right? That you draw sharp lines between people, you can end up with a clear identity. But if that line's too sharp, what happens? It cuts you off. Right? And so there's a lot of complexity to the questions, which is why I say that today we're living in a fundamentally different era. And we're not going to have time now to speak about what that era is. But last comment on Ezra, I'm watching the clock so we can bring Nehemiah into this discussion. It doesn't be last comment, but...
Please. Saying that when Ezra came back and found out what was happening, those surrounding nations, you're calling them now complete cultures. They were real cultures.
They had their own gods. They had their own languages.
Or he just didn't really care how much of a culture they had. He just felt,
I mean, I would be careful with the concept of culture. I mean, in the ancient world, there was blood, God, and land. Right, and that these people have been detached from their lands, by and large, because they were, like the Jews, had been taken away and brought to Babel. At least the way that the Tanakh presents it, these people have been taken away from their lands and brought to the land of Israel. Their blood relation, again, the way that Tanakh presents it, is something other. Now, remember, in the Torah, and even through most of the Tanakh up to our time, is the boundary of Israel, the people of Israel, is the geographic boundary. What does Ruth say? Where you go, I'll go. Your people will be my people. And then only after that, your God will be my God. Right? She's expressing that what it means to be an Israelite is to live in the land of Israel. Once Ezra comes back, it shifts to genealogy. That's one of the reasons I believe that genealogy plays such an important role in Ezra. We're starting to get today what we would think of as a racial concept, but what then was thought of as family. Only much later will what we think of come online, which is what the Book of Ruth is also about, which is conversion. Conversion doesn't have to do with geography. It doesn't have to do with genealogy. What does conversion have to do with?
Belief,
commitment. Yeah, these are very abstract notions. Right? That's a development of the boundaries of peoplehood that we're seeing. Ezra is in the middle of right now. And it's a messy process. Remember, all organic processes are messy. Never forget that. It's only inorganic processes that are clean. Right? And by and large, you wouldn't want to try to live any of them. So, okay. Let's bring Nehemiah into the picture here. So there are five different citations here. We're not going to see them all. But what did if you got a chance to see him, what's like, why is he so obsessed with the wall? Did you guys notice that? First he comes back, what does he do? Gotta check the wall, gotta see the wall. I mean, he even talks about how difficult it was. I don't know how far in the text he got me. I had to get down off my donkey, and I'm going, why? He had to circumnavigate the whole thing. Why?
Why? How well prepared or how much in disrepair was.
Yeah.
The gates exist, not exist.
Right. Meaning, don't undervalue the reality of survival. Don't undervalue the reality of survival that without a wall, forget all our cultural discussion and the intermarriage and Ezra's spiritual vision. Nehemiah says, listen, it's a tough world out there. And if you want this image, perhaps you're familiar with the story was that in 1946, I think it was the Peel Commission, if I'm not mistaken. My sort of early Zionist history is a little bit weak at the moment. The British were just trying to decide what would be the UN was trying to decide what would be the boundaries of the UN partition plan of 47. right? And they wanted to see to whom would the negev go. And overnight on Yom Kippur, the Zionists set up over a dozen what are called Chomah v'Migdal, stockading tower settlements in the negev, which meant what? They throw a bunch of people, a bunch of wood, and some electrical equipment into a truck, drive there, and overnight they would set up a wall and a tower. Here we are. So one end you'd say, well, that's meaningless. It's just a wall and a tower. What?
Facts on the ground.
It's not only facts on the ground. You can always fill it later. But if you don't have that wall there, you got nothing. Right? And Nehemiah is very aware of the needs for physical survival.
Well, I mean, I don't think it was as a fortification it counted for much. It was built to half its height when they finally did build it. The fact that it was one contiguous space, there was an inside. Once you have a contiguous space, you have an inside mm-hmm. and an outside.
Yep.
And if you're inside, you can feel outside, even if it's symbolic.
Yep.
You're not necessarily the fortification, not so great, but at least it made a clear boundary.
It creates a reality. Although I wouldn't undervalue with the steepness of the hillside he was building on.
Climb up over it. I mean, it's not really.
Yeah, but but they didn't. I mean, Sanballat said exactly that. A fox could climb over their wall, but it didn't. You know? Yeah.
I agree with you that the wall was built for survival. But the striking thing that I came up with from Nehemiah is he isn't talking about keeping raiders and marauders out.
No. Nope. What's he talking about? It is also that. Where did you see that line? What said that to you? It didn't have to be a specific line.
That is, for one thing, it comes in 22 in chapter 13.
Yes.
Preserving the sanctity of the Sabbath.
Yes. So I have a few pieces. First of all, I think we can all agree that the wall, be it a symbolic or practical, is an expression of safe space. We're all behind this wall. We're going to come to the Shabbat in a minute. There's also, by the way, and you see it in chapter 3, in those lines there at the end, when Sanballat was saying, look, what are the Jews doing? Are they going to restore things? Are they going to sacrifice? Will they make an end in the day? Are they going to revive the stones out of the heaps? Right? Right? So what does Nehemiah just say? You know, like, here, God, we're despised, we're prey in their hands, but we're going to keep building. A wall is also an expression of sovereignty. Right? There is a sense of, and in the world today, if you don't have borders, you don't have a state. This is one of the biggest challenges that the state of Israel faces. You know, forget whether one thinks there's a justice or an injustice to what's happening in the West Bank. Practically speaking, there's no border. And in today's world, if you don't have a border, you're not really a state. And so the state of Israel continues to undermine its legitimacy. Again, forget it. You can think that it's every inch of its Jewish land, or you can think that it's an oppressive occupation. It really doesn't matter. Either way, as long as there's no border there, we are undermining. Why? Because as I say to my right-wing friends, well, if it's really our land, then we're responsible for everyone that lives in it. Right? Like, or if I say to my left-wing friends, okay, then if it's not our land, then somebody actually has to be responsible for it. Like, you know, it doesn't work to just have null space in today's world. And you're already seeing it back here. A wall gives sovereignty by definition. I'm here, you're there. So we're almost at the sacred, but there's a couple more pieces. The one personally fascinating to me, here at Source 9 in chapter 6, is beloved to me because I used to work with at-risk youth. That was the one where he says the wall was built in 52 days. First of all, why did I put it there? Because it's just darn impressive. Right? Second of all, if I asked you to start building a wall, I don't think the first thing that would occur to me would be to spread people out over the entire hillside and have each person build their own little section. But it's genius. It's genius. Why is it genius? So I worked for a couple years with at-risk youth in a wilderness therapy program down in North Carolina. Anybody from Carolina? No? All right, one place. And we worked a lot with the process of group formation. Right? It's a very important, by the way, lens for this whole period in history. Right? The first stage of group formation is what's called a circumstantial or a situational group. You guys were all a situational group when you showed up here. Many of you may have known each other beforehand, but you became a group by how?
Forming.
Just by coming into the room. I mean, a situational group is I just draw a circle around a group of people. Notice the image. Be it literally or metaphorically, you all came into that Beit Midrash on the first day or into the other. You became a group. Now, that's meaningless on some level because you don't know each other's head, but it differentiates you from everybody who is not in the room. Right? It's the first stage of group formation is situational. Second stage of group formation is task-oriented group. You want to pull people together, you make them work together. So, by the way, it's one of the easiest ways of understanding when God saw the mass of the golden calf. I told you to come back up. Right? Forget theology. Forget editor. What's the response to the golden calf?
They work together.
Yeah, build this. Oh, yeah, they did work together there. It's a good point, right? Build this. A complex thing called the tabernacle. It's going to take them almost a year to do, and they're going to have to divide their tasks, and they have to learn to work together. That's what's called a task-oriented group. And here you have Nehemiah has just achieved an amazing, amazing accomplishment, which he's got these people to work together in building something which they will be able to point to forever and say, we did that. And you know what the most important word in that sentence is?
We.
Yes. You create a we through task accomplishment. There's another stage, by the way, which is known as primary group. Anybody here ever go to summer camp? Right? There's something about being in a cabin in summer camp that will last forever. I don't even remember the other kids in cabin 8. But I remember that I was in cabin 8. And that primary groupness is when your identity becomes bound up with the group, separate from the situation that created it, separate from any accomplishment it may have made, that you become part of cabin 8. Right? And what you'll see as the book of Ezra and Nehemiah go on is that this is exactly what they accomplished. By the way, what's the proof that they accomplished it? That we're sitting here in this room today talking about them. And that we somehow see ourselves as part of the same story. It doesn't get more successful than that.
So when the wall was built so quickly, Nehemiah was quick to point out God's help.
Yes.
The people around about were saying, hey, this is amazing. The Israelites, the people of Judah, had tremendous self-confidence and confidence in their God.
Tremendous self-confidence and confidence in God, for sure.
We've done it. We could stand up for anything else.
Yes. And that's part of the power. And when I used to work with at-risk youth, that's exactly why we would put them through very difficult 3-week canoe and backpacking trips or major building projects. You know, because how many times have I said to a kid who said to me, I can't do this? And I point to one of his accomplishments. You see that over there? You told me you couldn't do that either. But you did. And you're pointing out a very important point, is that one of the reasons we keep telling these stories is as history keeps presenting us with new challenges, we rest on the power of the fact that I don't know how we're going to get through this, but you know what the expression in Hebrew is? Avarno et paro, navor gam et zeh. Right? We got through Pharaoh, we'll get through this too. Right? And it's a joke, but it's actually not. It's quite serious. So there's only 2 minutes left, and we can't do justice to your point about the sacred and the profane. That is indeed the last. These last two sources point out is that there is something about a wall that allow in its power to divide, that allows us to distinguish between the sacred and the profane.
You can't close the gates if there's no gates.
You can't close the gates if there's no gates. Shabbat, and you know, Shabbat begins at a certain point. My daughter, gosh, I really hope she never listens to this stuff, right? There's a big struggle, actually not struggle anymore, because I don't struggle about it, but there was at a certain point a big struggle about modesty in our house, right? The world I live in and the values I hold and my understanding of the law is that there are boundaries to modesty, and my daughter, sharp-minded one that she is, at a certain point says to me, Abba, does it really make a difference if I put the sleeve of my shirt here or here? And I said to her, listen, you may not understand what I'm going to say, but you need to listen. I said, you've just put your finger on one of the biggest problems that life offers, and it is the problem of embodiment. In her case, what it is if you have a value called modesty, a value, we may all share it, values only find reality when they are embodied in some way. Right? Now, the way in which you embody modesty and the way in which I embody modesty might be different. We can have systems of law and authority about who gets to decide. That's not my point. My point is you are entirely right that there may be no intrinsic difference. But if I'm going to have a value, I have to actually express it some way. And if I'm going to express it some way, there's going to be a point at which I'm going to have to say, this is it and this is not. You hear the essence of why this wall is so important to the sacred and why it really illuminates this whole story. At some level, Ezra and Nehemiah are convinced that their mission is to build and preserve and grow the Jewish people. And that peoplehood, to be the Jewish people, there's got to be somewhere where we're going to look at and say, and that's not it. Oh, the people, you know, sort of like eating human flesh over there and burning their children to idols? Okay, everybody agrees that's not. But what about these people? What about those people? What about these people who from within married out? What about people from without who married in? You see, there's at some point, you're going to have to draw a boundary. But remember our image of the cell. If that boundary's too sharp, there's no life. That boundary's too porous, then you can't actually embody your values. This is the problem of embodiment. And it is really the core challenge that the books of Ezra and Nehemiah address, in my opinion. And it is the reason that they are wall builders. So that's it. It's 11 o'clock. We're going to stop there and we'll take a break for the next session.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.